Today at Reader's Corner, Brian Van Riet, author of Spoils. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In his powerful debut novel, Spoils, Brian Van Riet transports his readers to the messy, murky front lines of the Iraq War, and a morally complex landscape where the U.S. mission of winning hearts and minds is anything but clear. The fog of war is felt by American soldiers, Islamic jihadists, and the innocent Iraqi civilians caught in the crosshairs. Mr. Van Riet tells their intertwining stories with an emotional intensity and precision that is utterly believable. His book is a testament to the power of fiction to mine even deeper truths. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Brian Van Riet. He is a veteran himself who served in Iraq, achieved the rank of sergeant, and was awarded a Bronze Star for valor. Spoils is being published in 5 languages and has already received widespread critical acclaim, including being longlisted for the 2018 Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction and the 2017 Center for Fiction First Novel Prize. Mr. Van Riet's work has appeared in The Guardian, The New York Times, and other publications, and he has twice won the Texas Institute of Letters Short Story Award. He joins us today by phone for this interview. Brian Van Riet, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me here.
Brian, I read your novel and walked away feeling like I had learned so much about fighting a modern-day war in Iraq and Afghanistan, for that matter. And the thought occurred to me that, you know, Americans really don't know nearly as much about this warfare as they did during the days of the Vietnam War, for example, where every night Walter Cronkite was on with reporters embedded in among the troops, in the rice paddies. Occasionally we'll get some of that. But what I thought was particularly impressive about your novel, which people call fiction, is the truth within it, as I mentioned in my intro. I wonder if you could just comment on how you approached your novel. Obviously, you have to worry about plot, you have to worry about narrative, but it sure seems to me like you wanted to get a few messages across in the meantime, and you allowed your characters to do that.
Well, thank you. You know, writing this book was a series of trials and errors, going back to the drawing board, starting again, but through each draft, even the first, which is radically unlike what was published, I wanted to convey a sense of the futility of a war like this, the sense of waste. So those were some emotions that were present from the very beginning of it. And the final book is told from 3 very different points of view. The first draft was told from a perspective that's much more like my own. And that's one of the good things about writing fiction is you can get out of your own head. You can imagine the world as seen through other people. And I think the more that I did that, the more it freed me up to write, to consider things you're talking about, like the plot, the structure, how to build tension. So it's one of the paradoxes of fiction that, yeah, I'm trying to get at a truth of the war as I see it. But it's the farther I got from my own truth, the more I could get at that other capital T truth.
It's clear from some of the interviews you've had about this book, about writing the book, but even more importantly, about your experience in a tank in Iraq, that you weren't exactly the guy that one would expect to find in this circumstance. I mean, here you are, an Eccles scholar. That's like the Honors College at the University of Virginia. And 9/11 happens. And from my first reading of this, I thought, oh, there's a guy who just decided to exact revenge on those folks who did harm to us. And so he joins up. Apparently, it's a little more complicated than that, the way you were looking at it back then anyway.
Yeah. I was, like I said, I was in this prestigious academic program and I'd done well in high school. But I was one of those kids who, when I went away to college at 18 years old, 19 years old, I just couldn't quite handle the freedom and basically squandered my time there, although I did some writing, I made some friends, but didn't do so well in school. And so I never really thought about enlisting in the military during peacetime, but when a war broke out, I started to consider it. And yeah, revenge wasn't near the top of my list of motives. It was a much more impulsive and emotional decision. It was not a political decision. I was a reckless young man. I was 20 years old when I enlisted in November of 2001. And it was the same reason why a lot of young people join the military, this desire for adventure, but that's not quite the right word for it, to experience something momentous, to prove yourself. And, you know, I had my grandfather was in the military, so there was some amount of family tradition. But again, that's lower down the list. I mean, it's a blend of all these different things that I think most people's motives when they enlist are more complex than it is a simple, you know, get revenge or I need the money. Although, you know, all these aspects can play into it.
Well, what about the tank aspect of it? Did you go into the Army figuring, well, I really want to serve over in Iraq in a tank? Or did the Army decide that for you?
Well, it was a little of both. I wanted to enlist for 2 years, which is the shortest you could do, because I knew that I didn't think I wanted to make a career out of the military, and so I wanted to do the shortest amount I could. And there were only certain jobs you could do with a two-year enlistment. And I also knew that I wanted to do combat arms job, which those include things like infantry, armor when you're on a tank, artillery, special forces. And so a tanker was one of those jobs where I could do it for 2 years, and it was in combat arms. I thought a little bit about infantry, but it seemed like a better idea to ride in a tank than walk around, so I picked a tank. Again, it was one of those decisions you make over the course of maybe an hour in a recruiter's office, and you're determining the course of your future. But at 20 years old, you might not have much wisdom or foresight to figure out how it would all play out. Although I will say that even when I was signing that enlistment contract in November 2001, I thought maybe we would go to war in Iraq. And I don't really remember why I thought that. Maybe it was already being talked about in the media speculatively. Maybe I could kind of see the writing on the wall, but I do remember having that thought that maybe I would wind up in Iraq. And obviously Afghanistan was also a possibility.
I think I read somewhere that you were asked, what do you fear the most over there, especially when you're in a tank that can be so vulnerable? And I think your answer at one point was that it's not necessarily the fear of death, but the fear of being captured. And obviously that comes through in your novel, because there, again, I am always careful not to give away these novels, because you've got a great plot and narrative, and I want listeners to have a chance to work their way through it the way I did. But the fact is, I'm not giving too much away to say that there's capture involved in your novel. So I assume that that comes from your own experience and your own fears as a soldier over there.
Yeah. You know, when I was over there, it was right around the time when these terrible terrorist beheading tapes started to become a thing. You know, the first one might have been out of Afghanistan with Daniel Pearl, who was a journalist, but it was starting to become a thing in Iraq, and we were all aware of that, and we were all shaken by that. I mean, it was just horrific. And so, yeah, there was certainly a sense that we all thought to ourselves and said to ourselves, well, we won't be taken alive, because this is an enemy who will show no quarter. And I should also say that for the most part, the combat I was involved in was not against foreign jihadists, but more against local militias who were Shia. And so, you know, Iraq was this kind of proxy war where you had the U.S. trying to impose its will, and you had foreign extremists using it for their own purposes, and you had various Iraqi groups who were either nationalistic or had some religious overtone. So it was a very complex situation. But yes, the fear of capture was something I think we all felt. And, you know, in a very early draft of the book that had a totally different plot, there was some kind of throwaway line about the thing we all feared most was being captured. And at some point I read that and I realized, like, that had to be the plot of the book. For no other reason, it seems, I mean, the tension is there, and there's something about this new phenomenon that kind of speaks to a truth about the war. And I think after I finished writing it, I realized that it was the capture, the feeling of isolation and confinement was was very much a metaphor for how I felt being over there. When I was there, I was on stop loss orders. My 2 years were up, but I was still in the Army. There's a provision in your contract that says in a time of war or national emergency, you can be held in. And I was held in another 18 months. So I was, I was a little disgruntled about that. And I also had the feeling that I was in a place that didn't want me there, that didn't want us there. It was hostile to some extent, not even people who were fighting us, but just the average person on the street, certainly as our deployment wore on, they didn't want us there anymore. And you had a feeling of being trapped. And so that becomes very literal in the book.
I'm Bob Custer, a host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with U.S. Army veteran Brian Van Riet about his debut novel about the Iraq War, titled Spoils. Yeah, so much for that volunteer Army. I read that part about the stop loss orders, and I figured since you thought you were signing up for 2 years, that didn't work out too well.
Yeah, the Army is it is a volunteer Army, but once you volunteer, it's no longer.
That's right.
There are certain mandatory things, and I think the idea of the all-volunteer armies kind of hurt us because it allows people to think that if someone's over there, if they've re-enlisted, if they perhaps have done 4, 5, 6 combat tours, which isn't even that unusual anymore, sadly, that maybe that person wanted to be doing that. But it's always more complicated. There are people who get in the Army, maybe even pre-9/11 during the peacetime Army, and then they have a family, they build a career, you have a steady paycheck, you're getting good medical benefits. And so maybe you really don't want to go to war 6 times, but you do it because it's your profession. And so I think part of the apathy or the divide between the military and civilian people that we see could be alleviated if we had a draft or some kind of national service. But I'm under no illusions that's going to happen.
So you've created some incredible characters for this book. We might call them stereotypes, composites in a sense, trying to find a way to help those of us who haven't been there and who don't understand modern-day warfare in the Middle East, what it must be like. And I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about your female protagonist. That would be Cassandra Wigherd. Give us an idea of how this fits into your narrative.
Well, I prefer the term archetypes over stereotypes.
Sure.
But I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
She's a young woman from middle America who enlisted before 9/11 because, she wants to get away from home. She wants to prove herself. And some of the same reasons that I did it. And she enlists in a time, of course, when women were not allowed to serve in ground combat technically. And I say technically because from a very early point, they were. And she, she gets deployed to Iraq. She faces sexual violence, both from her own side, from guys in the Army, and from the other side. And she's very much a true warrior in a lot of ways. She's got grit, determination, and intelligence, and she's placed in an impossible situation.
And who are her male counterparts in this tank that, in a sense, are foils for who she is?
Well, she's on an armored gun truck, and she's with a sergeant, Sergeant McGinnis. He's kind of a Southern guy. He's protective of her in a fatherly way that can seem condescending. And then the other guy on her truck crew is a guy named Crump, and he's more of just kind of a loudmouth, clownish bigot in some ways. And you're absolutely right in saying they're foils. I mean, they're different types of people I've seen in the military and like you said, composites of people you might meet. And in different ways, they have kind of opposite approaches, Crump and McGinnis. Neither one works out. But I wanted to show how different personalities or types of people deal with an intense situation like that.
I had Craig Johnson, the author of Sheriff Walt Longmire novels out of Wyoming, on a couple of weeks ago. And he was joking about the fact that his father thought he figured out who Craig had used in his novel to look exactly like and feel exactly like his father. As it turns out, the father was actually wrong, and Craig was very pleased about that. But it does raise for me the question of whether or not these are just composites, or in some cases, are these like duplicates of people you met over there and worked with?
No, they're not. None of them are duplicates, and you're always drawing from life to a certain extent. So there were times when I thought about various people I had known in the military when writing some character, but I was never trying to write that person exactly. It's always you take a detail from one person, you take another detail that's imagined, and then maybe a third detail from research. I mean, I did a fair amount of research for this book, and so none of them are spot on. Although I will say that I nicknamed one of the medics in the book after a medic that I actually served with and was quite good friends with. So that was kind of that was more of an honorific detail than that's a very minor character. So yeah, they're more composites than they are portraits.
Well, you did an excellent job when it comes to trying to figure out the jihadist and why jihadists are in this business. I'm going to quote from your book here a bit and then ask you if you could comment. You just mentioned research, so it sure seems to me like you had to put some research in to come up with this. You're trying to describe here, and frankly, I even forget whose voice I'm going to read here, but it says it's one of the jihadists, I believe. It's a vexing paradox that the coarsest and most sinful among us often become the most pious. Itinerants, nomads, wanderers, young men banished from their homelands, lost to their parents, and older men like myself, strangers to our own families. We were all lost in the world's eyes. And then it goes on, the path from poverty to war was well trodden, but not the only path. And it would have been wrong-headed to assume that want of material things was what compelled us to this jihad. And then it goes on to say, men from prosperous families, the sons of merchants and engineers in the kingdom, they arrive seeking remedies for a spiritual poverty that wealth only exacerbates. That was Dr. Walid, by the way. But I wonder if you could just comment on, I don't think you learned that in a tank or an armored vehicle. You're obviously looking way beyond your personal circumstance in the war to come up with an analysis like that, which seems very accurate and on point to me.
Well, thanks. Yeah, that's in the war. I think the impulse to include that character in the story did come from the war in a way, because we soldiers spent a lot of time talking and speculating, and we were always speculating on the enemy, because you never get to meet them. We rarely even saw them. So you're always wondering, who are these people? Why are they fighting? Are they kind of just like us, except they were born in a different place? So that impulse translates into fiction very easily. But to write a character like this and to make it believable, you have to either have a lot of lived experience, which I don't. I mean, I have lived experience in armed forces, but not in that type of armed force. So you have to do some sort of research. I like to do research in books just because I feel like books are a very good distillation of people's experiences, and you can learn as much from reading a good book as you could from interviewing 20 people, especially for the purposes of fiction writing. But so yeah, I read some interesting memoirs by ex-jihadists. I read works of history, journalism. And yeah, I mean, the passage you read hits on a few themes that I found in these different works is that, you know, a lot of guys, there were certain types of jihadists who kind of had a conversion experience in prison. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq until he was killed in 2006, I believe, he was one of those guys. He was one that was coarse and sinful and kind of a street thug, for lack of a better word, until he, you know, had this conversion experience in prison in Jordan, and then went on to be a militant leader. And my narrator, my jihadist narrator, is more like someone like an Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's the deputy to bin Laden. He's an educated guy. He came from the upper middle class of Egypt. His parents were doctors and lawyers. And so it wasn't poverty that drove him. It was a sense of injustice and religious fervor. And again, I mean, the same theme of all the three main characters in my book have the three narrators. There's this wanderlust or a movement out of your sphere and into another sphere that leads people to volunteer for military groups. And so I tried to show the different types of people who wind up in these groups. And, you know, my narrator is one of the more sophisticated kinds who might end up leading a group like this. And many of the leaders have been sophisticated people. They come from wealth and privilege. Bin Laden, great example, you know, heir to an enormous part of an enormous fortune, but he wasn't interested in that. So it's there's a kind of one viewpoint where we think some people think that radicalism or jihad is purely a product of economic forces, that it's lack of opportunity from lack of education. And that's true to a certain extent. That's part of it, but it's not the whole story. And so I wanted to tell broader story.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Brian Van Riet, author of the novel Spoils. Hader. Hader is an 8-year-old. And yes. I'd like you to just help us understand the role of children, in this case, like Hader. When I read it, I have to say, first of all, that I literally spent pages worried about what was going to happen to Hader because I just didn't think this looked very good. That's number one, which is makes for a suspenseful read for sure. But secondly, it reminded me of the translators and the Iraqis that are usually assigned to certain soldiers. I have a friend who's a Marine who did 2 tours over there in Afghanistan, and he came back saying that were it not for this Afghan that did the translating, he'd be dead. It was way more than about translating. And, of course, what really concerns me about that, and this may be getting out of your wheelhouse, but I hear these stories about the difficulty of these folks who did so much for our soldiers leaving their countries and coming to America as refugees and how so many of them are stopped at our borders. Anyway, I wonder if you could comment on Hader, first of all, and if you have any thoughts on the other issue, that would be interesting as well.
I would pronounce his name Hader.
Hader, okay. Sorry about that.
Hader is an acceptable way from the text. It's hard to transliterate Arabic words into English and to make it spot on as to how the reader should pronounce it. But
right.
Yeah, Hader is – I met so many kids like that in Iraq. One of the tragic things about it is it's a very young country. I can't remember the percentage of the country that's under 20 years old, but it's some very high percent, like 40 or 50%. It's much higher than it is in the United States. And so you have this huge segment of the population that's known nothing but war, their entire lives, nothing but war, hardship, and misery. And I think that's one of the great tragedies, especially that, you know, at one point, one of the insurgent leaders says, at sometime in the future, these children will make the best sort of fighters. And it's true. And so Hader is, you know, the kids that I met in Iraq, it's amazing how often they were smiling. They were willing to greet us. You know, part of that, as I show in the book, is they wanted stuff. They wanted to beg chocolate off you or just to try out speaking English like children anywhere would. And so I wanted to put that character in there just because I think from different guys I've talked to who've served over there and from my experience, the children were just everywhere and they were a part of everyone's tour in one way or the other and sometimes very tragically. Mm-hmm. And so that's why Hader is in the book. What you said about the, that's another tragedy that we've had people, translators who have risked their lives and who have been entrusted with the lives of U.S. soldiers by virtue of their roles and sometimes have sacrificed enormous amounts in terms of the risk they put themselves and their families in. And they've had to jump through hoops to get a visa to immigrate to the U.S. And I haven't followed this story that closely, but there have been various efforts through legislation to give them kind of a expedited entry, but it seems like those have failed. And I know there are many stories of people who they've been killed for their collaboration, the other side would say, with the United States. And it feels like a betrayal to me, betrayal of our allies and of our ideals.
You mentioned sexual violence earlier, the sexual violence that Cassandra was confronted with. And I wonder how you assess that in terms of the overall role of women in the military and as you saw it in Iraq? I mean, what's your take on that?
When I was in the military, this was before women were allowed to serve in combat arms units like the one I was in. So I was in this unit where there were about 500 guys, zero women. And so I, on my day-to-day life in the Army, I had very little contact with women in the military. There were some women on my camp. One young woman was killed on my camp by an IED. But I ironically met more female veterans and service members after I got out of, at least, well, by met, I mean got to know more women who had served after I got out of the military than I did when I was in it. But with that said, you know, the kind of unit like I was in the military as a whole is a very macho and male-dominated institution. And so, yeah, you'd hear about, you know, various crimes, rapes that would happen on different bases. Women would be urged not to walk alone. And we're talking about their own comrades doing this to them, not the enemy. And so even back then, I realized that this was a very hostile place to be a woman. And that experience, in a weird way, when I sat down to write this book, felt more foreboding and out of touch from my own experience than that of a jihadist, a young jihadist, because I kind of got why, like, a 20-year-old angry, disaffected young man might join to, you know, volunteer to fight in a foreign war. But it was harder for me to understand why a young woman would want to do it until, again, I started to do more research, reading different accounts. And, you know, women join for all sorts of reasons, and they have many different types of experiences. I did a panel with a young woman who's a Marine veteran. Her name is Teresa Fazio, and she's an excellent writer. And she kind of preemptively, it came time for the Q&A session of this panel, and preemptively she said, before I get this question of what it's like to be a woman in the Marine Corps, let me just tell you, there are many different answers. There is many different answers as there are women who've served in the Marine Corps. So there's no monolithic experience, but there are some common things that I found through my thinking and research about this issue. And one of them is the threat of violence from men, which is really kind of universal to all women everywhere. I mean, men are the biggest physical threat to women, and that's true in the military as well.
Well, Brian, we've just about run out of time, but I, again, want to compliment you on the book. I'd like to thank you for your service, first of all, and then thank you for the insights you've given us who have been back here stateside trying to figure out these wars, and especially trying to find a way to honor and respect the newest generation of soldiers who are returning from war. And as I said early on in the interview, I don't think often enough the media covers our newest wars as well as they did back in the day. And it's just interesting to know that what we're learning most effectively about our most recent war, our current wars, in this case comes from a novel that, as I said, has deeper truths within it. So hats off to you. You got another novel in the works, by the way? I have to ask that, I guess.
I do. I'm working on one now. But it doesn't look to be a war novel, but probably going to be kind of dark because that's the stuff that troubles me and the stuff that I write. But yes, I am. And I'm really thankful for your time and attention. It's been fun talking to you.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Brian Van Riet. Next week, a President's Day weekend interview with Robert Mary, author of President McKinley, Architect of the American Century. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Andrew Fisher. Research by Sienna Madrid. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. If you missed any of our recent shows, including my conversation with William Drozdiak about his book Fractured Continent, Europe's Crises and the Fate of the West, you can find them on our website. That's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org, or download our free app from Google Play or the App Store to listen to these and other interviews anywhere, anytime.